Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Certainly a lot of interest in not only the Civil War itself, but the realities of life during that period. It's a very interesting life, not only the powerful and the influential who lived at that time, but sort of the average people who were just trying to survive. Lucky for us, one of Wisconsin's best and most successful authors has provided us with some new looks at different perspectives in that area. And as somebody who's read 100 and some books on the Civil War, it's really been a revelation for me and a really nice one, as a matter of fact, to learn about the people that Jennifer Cheverini has chronicled in her books. She's a New York Times bestselling author, I think best known and some, or at least well known, let's put it that way, for her Elm Creek quilt series, and certainly more recently for her standalone historical novels, like her latest. Her latest is called Mrs. Grant and Madam Jewel, and I'm always glad to have her with us. And Jennifer, thank you so much for taking time to come.
No, thank you. It's my pleasure.
You've done it again. You've got a wonderful book again.
Oh, thank you so much.
And it's, you know, your last four novels set in the Civil War era. And some of the characters make appearances in more than one of those stories, which I think is kind of cool. But they are standalone novels that you've written. What keeps drawing you to this period?
Well, I think it's a fascinating period in American history. So much was in crisis. So much was at stake. The entire American experiment could have just ended right then. But as a creative person, I'm drawn to this idea of the conflict, not only between states, but also how it affected, how it appeared within families. And the divisions of the Civil War, we always hear about how it was brother against brother, but it was also husband against wife, sister against sister-in-law. All of those conflicts came into play on the home front. And so many different stories emerge because we see the best about our country and the very worst of what we're capable of thrown into sharp contrast. We see absolutely horrific examples of how human beings can be absolutely inhumane to one another, but also you see these occasions where people had the opportunity to rise to personal heroism, to be self-sacrificing for a greater ideal or for their fellow human beings, and you see them rise up and do that. So the contrast between the very best and the very worst of America is fascinating to me as a storyteller.
And what's interesting to me, too, is that in your Civil War stories, you're certainly bringing out the lives of women who lived during that period. But you also, frame those stories in through their relationships, which are often rivals. And there's a lot of rivalry and negativity involved.
That's true. Well, you mentioned that some of the characters appear in the different books. Well, these are characters that are based upon historical figures. And as I've been writing about this time period, I've been intrigued to discover what a small world Washington, D.C. was during this era.
Yeah.
Everybody had maybe 2 degrees of separation, it would seem. And I've been fascinated by the stories of the people who are usually put to the margins, or they're included as a footnote. I think it's important for us to study the great men of this time period. We need to know what Lincoln's accomplishments were and Grant's were. But I think that American history, the story of our country at this time, isn't just about the presidents and the generals. I've always been interested in what was everybody else doing in these circumstances? What were families doing? What were mothers of small children dealing with? What were shopkeepers dealing with? Because to me, those stories that we usually don't learn about in school, but those stories are just as essential to the America we became in the 21st century as all of the people that we typically do study in history classes.
And I think this might be a good point to bring up the fact that this is a novel, but it's based on, I mean, you do so much research on your pieces. So they're you're putting words in people's mouths sometimes.
Yes, I am. Sometimes I have to. But that's one of the great things about writing fiction. Now, I love doing the research. I always start out at the Wisconsin Historical Society, which isn't too far from where we're speaking right now.
Right.
They have a wonderful archive for any possible historical topic you could ever want to know anything about. So I always begin there, reading secondary research, as well as getting back to those wonderful primary documents that are so rich with the period detail and the voices of the people who lived in those eras. So I usually start out there with my research, and I think that I do certainly value nonfiction. I love to read nonfiction. I rely upon it as an author. Mm-hmm. But one of the wonderful things about writing fiction is that it lets you speculate. We don't really know what people were thinking. We aren't privy to every intimate conversation. We can go and see what people recorded in their diaries, but people have been known to be selective about what they include. So one of the great things about writing historical fiction is I can do the research, I can learn about a period, and I can try to present that and make it real for my readers, but I also can put them in the mind of one of the people who existed at that time, who went through these different events, to really help evoke the reader's understanding and all their empathy for the character, whatever they're going through. And that's something that fiction does particularly well, because it places you in the perspective of these different characters.
Well, at the same time, though, a lot of what you're writing about happened.
That's true. That's true. Now, it says a novel on it, so I have a license to make up whatever I want. But I try not to depart from the historical record just for the sake of making my storytelling easier. For example, Julia Grant in my new book might have been a more sympathetic character if I had made her an abolitionist. Mm-hmm. And that would have been a lot easier to write.
Yeah.
But I can't do that knowing that she was not, and she really didn't understand what the big deal was about it. I mean, and that's not something that, as a 21st century person, I find particularly admirable in a first lady. In fact, quite the opposite. So I won't move the time of a Civil War battle. I won't do things like that. I won't just say, okay, well, I'd rather write about an abolitionist, and so I changed Julia. I can't bring myself to do that. But where minor events and minor characters in my main character's lives are concerned, I do feel like I can take a little bit of license. I might make a composite character out of several cousins who came to visit, or several different clerks that worked for General Grant. I might only focus on one. So I feel okay doing that, but just to make sure my readers are okay with it too, I always include that author's note explaining where I did depart from the historical record.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today. She's been our guest many times on many of the novels that she's written. She's written 24, and her latest is titled Mrs. Grant and Madame Jewel, and it's another Jewel, a different kind of jewel, J-E-W-E-L. I think we can call it that. You can join in. Have you read her books, any of her books? Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you have questions about Mrs. Grant or of some of the other women who lived during that time period. She's written about many of them. Number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR. That's talk@WPR, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Well, in this novel, as you say, you're writing about Mrs. Grant and the First Lady of the United States, and Julia, her name was Julia Dent Grant, and about her slave.
That's right.
She had a slave.
She, the wife of the Union General in Chief, was a slaveholder. Now, there's some debate about whether Julia owned her slaves or whether her father actually owned them. But to me, that question is not really important. Whoever actually laid claim to them is one thing. There's no question that Julia definitely benefited from the exploitation of other human beings. So sometimes people try to put her in a better light by saying, well, they were really her father's slaves. the point is, she kept slaves. She had them on her staff, and she wasn't terribly troubled by owning other human beings.
Yeah, and she was with Jewel for a long time. I mean, they kind of sort of grew up together in a way.
They did, and although Julia has left her mark on the historical record, she wrote a memoir of her own, and she was in the press quite a lot because of her status, not only as the general's wife, but also as first lady. There's very little about Jewel in the historical record. So almost everything in the novel about Jewel is fictionalized. Doesn't mean it's fictitious. I drew upon the accounts of other emancipated slaves writing after the war, studying other historical records about the different places that Jewel would have been living. So they are drawn upon, they do draw upon the historical record, but Jewel did not leave behind the kind of memoir or record that Julia did. So, but they did, in my novel at least, they grew up together. But of course, their paths have to diverge because of their different places in society.
Well, the interesting thing is her name Jewel, which was really, it was Julia, is it not?
Yes, that's true. And that is documented in the historical record. Julia did have a slave whose name was also Julia, but she was usually referred to, the slave was usually referred to as Black Julia. And the mistress got to keep the name Julia. And sometimes she was also called Jewel. So I went with Jewel in my book. And I have a story about how her name possibly could have been changed. And I have Julia having some agency in that, too.
Jeff in Warrens, Wisconsin, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just got a couple things, and I was listening, and one is that I've got a vested interest in the war between states a little bit. My great-grandfather was 16 when he went down with the 7th at Gettysburg and came back, actually. There weren't a lot that made it back from that particular battle. But about a month ago, I came across a document from way back. And it turned out to be an actual bill that was presented before Congress that designated Gettysburg as a national park. And it's the original bill. I got a picture with it and an article. The picture is of the guy that was with the Pennsylvania regiment, and he's got a little handwritten scribe on it about something that happened to him. And it's very brittle.
Are you wondering what to do with it?
Well, I know what I'm going to do with it. I'm going to have my dad make a special frame for it. But it's probably something that should be, at least some people should look at it.
Yeah. And that's may have been the kind of thing, and thanks a lot for calling, Jeff, that may have been the kind of thing that you would come across or have come across. I know in other books, in one of your other books, you wrote about Gettysburg, as a matter of fact.
That's true. In the Union Quilters, I did write about it. Now, General Grant wasn't at Gettysburg, so that doesn't figure into this book. But as far as this document that Jeff has found, I would encourage him to contact the Wisconsin Historical Society. If they don't have people right there who can advise him, they certainly can direct him to other sources.
I think you're absolutely right, Jeff. You should get a hold of them just for nothing else, for their advice.
Absolutely.
Because there are some really good people over there, and the Wisconsin Historical Society, as Judith is reminding me, has the finest collection of North American history in the country.
Absolutely.
Not just Wisconsin, but for the...
Now, that's quite right. You'd think from the name. But, of course, they have wonderful resources on Wisconsin history. But any subject you would want to know about, they've got it there, and they have wonderful staff who can advise you.
How many hours have you spent there over the year?
I don't even know. I should probably start paying rent. I've been there so much.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I've decided that I can never move away from this area. area because I have to be within an easy commute of that building.
Talking today with Jennifer Cheverini about her latest book. It's titled Mrs. Grant and Madam Jewel. And Harold and Superior, we're going to get to you in just a minute. You can join in, too. If you have a question or comment for Jennifer, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or certainly post on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can do that. We will be back with her right after this look at the news. You stay with us. There's certainly a lot of interest, not only in the Civil War itself, but the realities of life during that period for not only the powerful and influential, but also the average people trying to survive. And that's one of the reasons that I'm really happy to have Jennifer Cheverini back, because she's done a wonderful job of chronicling that, those experiences in several books, including her latest, which is out just today, as a matter of fact. Today's the launch, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. The title of the book is Mrs. Grant and Madam Jewel, and I've had a lot of fun reading it, and I know you will as well. Questions for her as we visit about her book, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Harold and Superior has been waiting a while, so let's go to Harold. Harold, thank you for waiting.
Well, good afternoon, I think it is.
Yep, it is.
Something I, you know, in thinking about the Civil War, and I think we sleepwalk through life sometimes just putting it out of our mind. You know, you ask younger people, or when I was younger, and it was just horrific. And the more you think about, gee, going in there and having a leg or limb sawed off with no painkillers or anesthesia and antibiotics, oh, I don't know how even people survive that one. You'd think they'd die from shock. But at any rate, one of the things I'm really baffled about is, you know, I can understand why the people from the North might have been fighting against slavery, because that was very immoral and against, mm-hmm. I would think, most religions. And, you know, they probably wanted the country to be unified and so on. But what was the benefit for somebody in the South joining and putting their life at risk, unless they were a slave owner? What was the benefit to them?
To them. Mm-hmm.
Well, what was the benefit? Maybe we could speak instead of what was their motivation. Why would they enlist? And a lot of the reasons were the same, both North and South. Young men hear stories of war and adventure, and they want to leave their small farm towns or leave home and go out and prove themselves as men and make a name for themselves and have adventure and excitement. That was common for both people in the South as well as the North. There was a lot of state patriotism as well. One of the famous lines from in some Civil War history that's often quoted in secondary sources about Civil War history, one young soldier, Confederate soldier, was asked, "Well, why?" by a Union soldier, "Why are you fighting us?" And he replied, "Well, because you're down here." You know, the Union Army came into their states, and by golly, they're going to force them out. General Robert E. Lee. became part of the Confederacy because of his loyalty to his state of Virginia.
Yeah.
He was originally offered leadership of all of the Union armies, and he was very torn because he had been in the military, he had been for the United States, but he loved his state of Virginia, and whatever Virginia did, that was what he was going to do. And so, of course, he ended up becoming the supreme general of all of the Confederate forces. So a lot had to do with just being loyal to the state rather than to the entire United Nation. But part of it was for financial reasons as well. You know, you could get paid mm-hmm. when you were a soldier. And there was also something about buying substitutes. I had one great grandfather who fought for the Union. I had another who fought for the Confederacy. He was from Georgia, and he moved to Alabama. And I could tell from the records that you can mm-hmm. find in the National Archives, he was someone who joined the military as a substitute, which means if a wealthier man might get drafted, they can pay to hire someone else to go in their place. And my great-great-grandfather needed the money. He was a poor man. And so that's why he enlisted, because he needed the money for his family and his many children. And so there are all kinds of motivations for why people in the South might have wanted to fight.
I'm interested in the motivation of what motivated Julia Grant and General Grant to get together in the first place, because they were so, as you write about, they're so opposite.
Well, that's true. This is not a couple that any matchmaker would think to put together, because they really do came from very different worlds. Julia was the pampered daughter of Missouri slaveholders. She was very popular, very well-liked. She was a little shy, but she was a wonderful dancer and a beautiful singing voice. And she had this idyllic childhood, grown up, loved by her siblings, and she loved where she lived in Missouri, in St. Louis, and in the family homestead of Whitehaven. And her husband-to-be, Ulysses S. Grant, he was the son of Ohio abolitionists, and he grew up working in his father's tanning business in a very strict household, although he hated that working in the tannery business. He absolutely despised it.
Wasn't very good at it either, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it's challenging to be good at work you hate, but he was as good as any young boy. But what he was really good at was horsemanship. He was an excellent rider, he was excellent with horses, and he was quite good at mathematics as well. So when he had the opportunity to go to West Point to study mathematics and to get out of the family trade, he absolutely went for it. But these aren't two people that you would think would come together and have a happy marriage. Their families were very much against them marrying. Julia's father thought that Julia was not at all suited for the life that she would have as a military spouse. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he wasn't General Grant, he was still Lieutenant Grant at this point. When he asked Mr. Dent for permission to marry Julia, her father actually suggested that he marry one of the sisters instead, who would be more suited for the roving life of a military spouse. Ulysses he put that idea to rest right away. So Julia's father made them have a 4-year-long engagement before he finally agreed, okay, maybe this is going to last after all. Ulysses' parents were upset that he was marrying into a slaveholding family, and they refused to attend the wedding.
Yeah.
And even later in their married life, they did try to intervene. When Ulysses would go to his family for some help, maybe employment, maybe a loan, they would sometimes use that financial need to try to drive a wedge between the two, which fortunately neither of them gave into. And they were happily married for decades, despite
40 years or something.
Yes, absolutely, despite the differences in their backgrounds and in their worldview.
And as you write about in the book, and this is all true, she followed him around on the battlefield. She was...
Absolutely. And that was something that really fascinated me about her when I was first coming across her while I was writing about Mrs. Lincoln, for example. We have this idea that all of the wives were safe at home, hundreds of miles away from any danger, but not so Julia. Ulysses hated to be away from his family. He really enjoyed having all of them close. And so whenever he would move with his armies to a new location, as soon as he felt that he was established and it was safe enough, he would summon Julia to join him. Sometimes she would bring one or more of their 4 young children along to military headquarters. quarters. And of course, the children loved that. And General Grant loved having the children around. But this absolutely astonished me that instead of staying safe at home with her own family or with his, she was enduring all of the hazards of travel at that time. And travel was quite challenging, even in the best of circumstances. And what I was also fascinated, though, that when she traveled, she usually had Jewel with her. So
yes.
All of the dangers and hazards that Julia voluntarily exposed herself to, Jewel had no choice.
She had to go.
She absolutely had to. And I just imagined, what would it have been like for her being a slave in the Union Army camp, the slave of the wife of the general who was leading the war that was going to presumably end slavery forever. And as the Union Army took over more territory, slaves would be emancipated or they would escape from territories still held by the Confederates and they'd make their way to Union lines. The nickname given to them was contraband. They were called contraband.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the people got jobs working for the Union Army. The men did a lot of manual labor. The women took on jobs such as laundresses and making shirts and all of those different things. So Jewel, still a slave, was in the military camp seeing all of these other African Americans gaining freedom and living as free people for the first time. And yet she was in Union territory, and yet she was still enslaved. And that captivated my imagination so much that that's really what inspired me to write the book.
Yeah, it's really, really a fascinating story. And as you said earlier in the show, this didn't seem incongruous at all to Mrs. Grant.
No, it didn't. And, you know, we wish that she would have been, after exposure to her husband's ideas of abolition and, you know, respecting people of, you know, all backgrounds, although he did not also have some racial issues of his own.
Yeah.
He certainly did. There were a lot of abolitionists who were not necessarily people who believed in equality of the races. They thought that slavery was an evil for many, many different reasons, but that didn't necessarily mean that they saw African Americans and white Americans as equal. And you know, that could perhaps explain why they could accept Julia having a slave. It's difficult to we can imagine the whispering that probably went on behind her back with the other wives that were there who were maybe from northern states who certainly did not share her views on how appropriate it was to have to keep a slave.
And speaking of other wives, Mrs. Lincoln, you write about...
Yes.
My goodness me.
Yes. Well,
they did not get along, or else she did not like Mrs. Grant, I guess you could say.
Well, Mrs. Lincoln was devoutly loyal to her husband, and she did not like any challengers to his role as president. That's one of the reasons why she had an intense dislike for Kate Chase, a heroine of my previous novel, Mrs. Lincoln's Rival, because her father wanted to be president. Well, at this point, Ulysses S. Grant did not want to be president. In the 1864 election, there were a great many people calling for him to run for president. And he was absolutely appalled by the idea.
Yeah.
He thought the only way that he was going to be able to, or that the Union would win this war, it was if Lincoln stayed where he was, and if Grant stayed where he was. Any change in that, he thought, would be a disaster. And he wanted to stay where he was doing the job he was doing. So even though he was adamantly opposed to running for president, people were calling for it, and so that, of course, alerted Mary Lincoln. So before that was going on, she quite liked Julia Grant because Julia was shy and bashful when she came to Washington. And she deferred to Mrs. Lincoln. at one point at a grand reception where Mary Lincoln was holding the receiving line and she was greeting all the well-wishers, she actually invited Julia to stand there with her and help greet people. And Julia said, oh, no, no, you're Mrs. President. You should stay here. This is your place. And, of course, Mary Lincoln just loved that. So at first, their relations were quite cordial. But the higher that General Grant rose in the esteem of the American people, the more concerned Mary became. And so her feelings towards Julia Grant took quite a turn. And she was also quite vocal in her criticism of General Grant. She, like many others, considered him a butcher. She thought he sends soldiers out there with absolutely no concern for their welfare, not caring about the thousands that get slaughtered. Well, that's the perspective on General Grant we get from Mary Lincoln. Julia Grant, of course, has a very different perspective. She has different insight into it. She believes that her husband, and she knows him, so she knows he cares about every life lost. But from her point of view, he believed that by sending lots of soldiers out there and by having this devastating battle, he would ultimately shorten the war and thereby ultimately save lives. But that is both of those viewpoints are something that historians even today still debate about. They still debate about whether that was the right call.
We had a listener, Catherine, who is a proud sustaining member, by the way, wanted to mention that your books are always found in libraries, and you're obviously a big supporter of libraries.
I am, and not just because my sister is a librarian, although that does play an important role in it. Oh, absolutely. I go to the library and check out books and all of that, just like everyone else too. In fact, several of my book tour events are going to be in libraries, and librarians really know how to get the word out. So it's always a great time. We always have a nice turnout and lots of very interesting questions.
I did want to bring it up because I know this is the launch day, and actually even today you're at Barnes & Noble in Westtown.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Tonight, I should say, at 7 p.m.
At 7 p.m., I'll be there to take readers' questions and sign books and have a great evening.
And probably do a little reading.
I'm not sure what I'm going to read yet. I still have to make that choice.
And then March 11th, you're at Matheson Memorial Library in Elkhorn.
That's right.
I don't have a time for that.
Well, that's 6:30. At 6:30,
correct. 6:30, yeah, I've got it here. And then 6:30 at Weinberg Public Library in Mequon.
That's right. I'm looking forward to that.
So I wanted to mention those. I didn't want to forget that. And I wanted to make sure that we got those dates in before we ran out of time here. There are so many fascinating parts to this book. One of the more poignant parts is nearer the end when Mr. Grant is infirm and trying to finish his memoir.
Right, that's
second,
right. That's right.
Memoir.
That's right. He had done some writing about his military experiences, and I don't think this qualifies as a spoiler because it's part of American history. But yeah. he was quite a heavy cigar smoker. He started out with pipes, but then one time he was described on the battlefield as having a cigar and the only reason he was smoking that cigar was because he didn't have any pipe tobacco, and someone gave him one, and so lots of admirers sent him box after box of cigars and continued to do so he switched to cigars. And near the end of his life, he suffered horribly from cancer of the throat and tongue. And not too long before his diagnosis, his family fortunes were lost. They were swindled out of it in a banking scheme.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And so even though he had also retired from the military, he had resigned from the military in order to run for president. So he was no longer going to receive a military pension. So he found himself, after two terms as president, after leading the Union Army to victory,
broke.
Absolutely broke. They had a lot of wonderful mementos that they had picked up through their world travels, and they owned some property here and there, but they had absolutely no cash. They could not pay their grocery bill. So he had resisted the suggestion to write a memoir for many years. But then he realized that he had to find a way. He knew he was dying. Julia had not quite accepted that yet, but he knew he had a limited time remaining to him, and he had to find a way to provide for his family. So he accepted an offer to write his memoir, and it was an absolute ordeal of writing this. He enjoyed the writing process. It gave discipline and order to his days. He was quite a good writer. He was known for that. His military reports even were known for their precision and their brevity and directness. And that's something that would be essential when you're trying to get important information across in a way that where you can't allow for any error. But he was suffering. He was starving because it hurt so much to swallow. So he was in great, great pain as he was writing this memoir. And for Julia, who is absolutely devoted to him.
Yeah, it was terrible.
It was so difficult to watch him struggling. But I imagine it also must have given her great pride, too, because here was another battle that he was going to fight through enormous pain because he cared so much about making sure that after he was gone, his family was provided for.
It's a fascinating, and there is so much more. You know, obviously we have not been able to cover even a 1% of what you have in this book. It's a wonderful read, and I know you're going to have a lot of fun going around the country talking about it. You'll be all over the place, won't you?
Well, I'm mostly in the Midwest, which is great, and one stop down to Florida, which will be very nice. Mm-hmm. Some new libraries that I've never been to, other wonderful independent bookstores I've visited before, and it's always great to have readers come out and to hear their questions and to hear their own experiences with some of their family history. Readers always like to share those stories with me, and I always enjoy hearing them.
And you're working on a new book, I presume?
I am, actually. I have a book coming out at the end of October, and this is it's called Christmas Bells, and it's inspired by the Longfellow poem of the same name. And this book bridges two eras. We see Longfellow when he was writing this poem in the Civil War, and then we also see contemporary characters and how the poem is still relevant to them in their lives. So that'll be another book coming out at the end of this year.
So see you then.
I certainly hope so.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Jennifer Cheverini's book is Mrs. Grant and Madam Jewel. It's launched today, and we've got some great information about it on our website at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page as well. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.